is real weird. Hey guys, I'm Will from Tested, and thank you for coming to our first Google Hangout on Air. Adam, you're here.
Here I am. Hello.
We are in different cities around the world, but we have a ton of time, about 30 minutes blocked away to answer questions and kind of chat about stuff. First things first, though, I have to show off.
Dude.
Because I got them. They're
you
real
have a
warm.
Tangerine.
I figured if you're going to wear something that people are going to be staring at you for anyway, why not get the orange ones?
Yeah, so. I ordered the white. I ordered cotton. Sorry, cotton.
Probably the right response. But if you want to know more about the Google Glasses, I'm going to go ahead and plug because we have the I wrote up basically the first 24 hours experience, and it's on Tested now, so you can check that out if you're into that.
Awesome.
Let's see. I think we have some questions ready to go, queued up and ready to go. The first one is, and I don't know who this is from, but it's Adam. Have you made a go bag, like the one from the movie Spartan?
No. You know, I haven't made a go bag from Spartan. It's a good question. I think you're asking two questions there. One is, have I made a go bag for myself, right?
It's just like a bug out bag, like you get out of prison, like get out of the
right.
city bag.
So there's that, and that's definitely no, because I don't really feel like I'm going to have to escape anywhere, or do I need a bag that houses everything I need to get from wherever I am to some other place in the world in 36 hours? But I am very interested in what's in that go bag, in Val Kilmer's go bag in Spartan, but I've never been able to get any genuine information about what might be in that bag. I'd love to, you know, get in touch with Kilmer's expert on that because, you know, I'd like to know the contents of that. That'd be a great prop to replicate.
There's not pictures and stuff in the movie, right? It's just
No. You only ever see, I think, he's got a knife and a pistol that he pulls out of that bag, and that's it. But presumably, you know, there's some gold in there, there's some cash, there's some credit cards, there's some clothing, there's a whole bunch of useful stuff.
Is there an opportunity for the best bug out bag? Like, is it Jason Bourne's? Is it the one from Spartan? Like, who does the best, oh shit, I've got to get out of here bag?
That's a good question. Right now, I mean, for me, it's hard to top the Jason Bourne bag. I mean, I love that movie so much. Owning that bag and filling it with all that stuff is so thrilling. I have a whole shelf in the cave devoted to it. I love that thing.
Cool.
It would be hard to top that.
So we have another Gus Griswold wants to know, Adam, are those Beats?
Where?
He's asking about your headphones.
Oh, wait, who are these? These are, no, they have an S logo on the side. They're somebody else.
Somebody that starts with an S. Okay.
You know what this, you know, I know that these are like some sort of popular headphone. These were a gift from Discovery a few years ago. And the fact is I love them because I'm slightly hard of hearing, so they make hearing really easy. And they've got a microphone here, so they work on my telephone. So I use them all the time when I'm doing interviews. They look ridiculous, I recognize.
But they sound nice, so that's good.
They do. The other thing that I'm surprised by is that Discovery, they had the choice of, like, black.
Oh, no.
And they bought me the blue.
Well, they wanted to bring out the color in your eyes.
I'm not sure what they were thinking, but, you know, I've used them ever since. They're darn good. These are way better than Beats.
Of course, naturally, yes. The next question is from Nelson Gill, and he wants to know, what was your biggest maker failure and what did you learn with it? So the biggest failure is a tough question, because I know, like, there's a lot of, you get that asked that a lot, but
yeah.
Like, what are some memorable failures, I think?
Well, it's a long story. At Maker Faire a few years ago, I did a preliminary a talk about failure, and I described this job that I did that went, well, these two different jobs that I did that went very, very sour. One was for a friend of mine producing a student film. I did the art direction and set building and totally messed it up and lost a friend in the process. It was really awful.
That sucks.
You can go find that at who are the guys that do all the Maker Faire talks?
Voda, Fora TV.
Fora TV, that's it, Fora.tv. Those guys have a fantastic archive of my talks from Maker Faire's past. And that's genuinely, don't get me wrong, those are tough stories to sit through. I learned to actually temper that story with a few jokes so that at least there was a reward for sticking around, because as I told them at Maker Faire, they're just sort of unrelentingly brutal.
I mean, one of the things I always hate is like doing something and messing up, and then you end up taking a bunch of people's time. I know you've talked about that happening in the show and other places. So anytime you like, people are waiting on you is bad. I know
it's rough. It's terribly rough. And in film special effects in Los Angeles, I know that there's a term, because often when you're a special effects guy, you know, they're shooting this big movie and they got a star out and everything, but then there's a time for an effect to work, like a, who knows, like an axe has got a, you know, pshink, or some handcuffs have to have a light go on, and that always requires an effects technician to make that thing work. And when you're that technician, man, the clock is ticking and everyone is staring and no one cares what your problems are, no one gives a crap what kind of day you've been having, you just got to make it work, because this crew costs like 10 grand a minute. And in effects, we've referred to that as being in the barrel. You are in the barrel. As for the etymology of what in the barrel means, you're going to have to Google that yourself, but I warn you, it's a pretty dirty joke.
It's like the guy who left Obama's speech in the back room the other day when he was coming out to the press conference.
Oh, man. Oops. Yeah, that would be bad. Whoops.
The next question comes from Nelson. Oh, wait. Drobert. Oh, I'm not going to ask you about LARPing. Harry She One wants to know, when will we be seeing your R2-D2 on Tested?
Oh. You know, it's funny. I've been neglecting to show him on Tested because he needs new motors in his feet, and I didn't want to show him off until he was ready to go. But maybe I've got a little time this summer. I will spend some time getting R2-D2 back up and running and fully remote control, and then we can do a nice introduction, because he deserves to be seen. He's beautiful.
And he was one of your you built him yourself, right? I mean, you from scratch.
He is from parts that were laser cut, and then I welded them together. There's a whole internal frame structure. Yeah, he's built from scratch over about a 6-year period.
Awesome.
He's a relatively short project.
Yeah, speedy.
Yes.
Mike Chastain wants to know if you have any tips on cutting foam core.
Oh yeah. Sharp blades have tons and tons and tons of sharp blades. I actually, it's funny, I have a bit of foam core right behind me in this desk I've been planning to cut out, but I haven't because I didn't have the right X-Acto blade, so I just went out and bought one with a bunch of blades literally like yesterday so I could cut this thing out. The trick is paper has a structure that actually dulls knives faster than almost anything else. So your X-Acto blade comes out of the box really, really sharp, and within just a few feet of cutting, it's going to get very, very dull. And you need to be ready to swap it out. I think one of the biggest problems I saw when I was teaching students at the Academy of Art was that no one knew to get rid of the sandpaper very quickly and go to a new piece right away rather than just burnish it with this polished piece of sandpaper filled with your stuff. And the same thing with blades. Blades are inexpensive, but they allow you to cut stuff cleanly and perfectly. Just keep on going through them. I was sad to only buy this box of 20, I think, 20 number 11s. I usually buy them 100 at a time.
Excellent. Tucker Nielsen wants to know, with your amazing ability to create duplicate movie props, such as the Blade Runner gun and Fifth Element gun, are you ever interested in purchasing the original article? I think those are bad examples, because those don't exist.
No. They both exist. The original Blade Runner gun sold for over $200,000 at auction a few years ago. The Fifth Element ZF-1 guns, I know that they have sold privately. None of them have come up for auction, and I don't know what price is sold for privately, but it was more than I would want to spend. I absolutely would not be above paying for an original prop, but... I'm not into spending $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 on something like that. It would have to be a mighty, mighty rare and special thing. I'm more into trading or trading information and then making my own. That's definitely, you know, even as my income has gone up over the years and I could afford more, I'm still not interested in throwing crap loads of dough at those things. It's more satisfying in the end to traded for something with the guy who made it, or again, building it from scratch.
Excellent. Drobert wants to know if you've tried the Oculus Rift.
I have tried the Oculus Rift. Didn't you see this on Tested? I got sick almost right away.
I think you tried it on and we're off so quick we didn't even have the cameras rolling.
Right. So we should do a thing about that. It gave me motion sickness very quickly. It was so accurate. I'm dying to try it out. on a longer scale because I really, really liked the way it felt.
If people don't know, we should tell them the Oculus Rift are the 3D goggles. They're VR goggles, basically.
But they're really, really, their design is fantastic, and the kind of intuitive response when you move your head with them is terrific. I really look forward to spending some more time with those.
And there's a ton of new demos out now, so you can see, like, people have built experiences with them that are supposed to be pretty cool. There's, like, a getting your head chopped off in the French Revolution simulator. There's all sorts of, like, flying along the outside of the ISS and all sorts
that
of
would
stuff.
Be cool.
It's pretty neat.
I'd like to fly. That's the main thing I'd like to do with it. So here's what I was thinking. I was thinking one of my cameramen has been investing in quad rotors for GoPro cameras.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we've been doing some really cool stuff on MythBusters with that. But I was thinking, couldn't I attach a GoPro via wireless to an Oculus Rift and then just fly where I wanted to?
So that's what I've been working on, is the telepresence thing with that. And
yeah.
With motors, it doesn't work because the servos lag too much and you get really, really motion sick really fast. But it seems like you could just project the video on the inside of a sphere and then look around inside the sphere, and you won't have the full 360 degrees, but you'll probably have enough to fly around on a helicopter. So we should talk.
Totally.
Let's see. Kevin Ho wants to know, have you ever thought about making your own full-size Dalek? Dalek? I'm not a Doctor Who guy.
I must admit, I have not thought about making a full-size Dalek. It is not part of the sci-fi universe that totally blows my dress up. It's only just out of ignorance. I haven't watched much Doctor Who, and that is a big giant prop. I mean, it's actually kind of shocking when you build your own R2-D2 to discover what a large footprint R2 actually requires.
Yeah.
I think the Dalek would be that times two.
It's just a trash can, right? I mean, wasn't that what they started out as, a trash can with a plunger on the front? I mean, ugh.
Now. Let's not start any arguments.
Start science fiction snobbery. Mark Beeson wants to know, are you planning to cosplay at Comic-Con, and are you going to give us any hints, or is it too soon?
It is too soon for hints, and the only reason is because I have to think up really clever hints that people don't guess in, like, a minute. I do have two cosplays that I'm going to do at Comic-Con this year. I believe I'm currently thinking about one on Thursday and one on Friday. That could change, and whatever the change will be, I'm going to tweet the hell out of it. But I'm very excited about my cosplay this year. It's a costume I've been wanting to do for years. One of my favorite minor characters. There you go. There's a hint.
It's a minor.
Yeah, what is minor?
Yeah.
It's not that guy running with the ice cream maker from Empire Strikes Back.
Let's see. Random TV USA wants to know, what do you think of the FS700, and have you done any short films yet?
I haven't done any short films yet with it, but I've used it a ton, and I love this camera. I'm really, really excited about it. I actually have a nice rig for it. We've used it on MythBusters a ton as an overshoot camera. We shot another pilot for Discovery recently that we used it on extensively. It's a fantastic piece of machinery. I love it. I'm very excited about the 4K upgrade, mostly for what it adds in terms of the camera's high-speed capabilities. That's actually where it really shines. Up to 8 seconds at 240 frames per second, you can get some really great stuff. And then actually, when Jamie and I were on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, we were actually using the FS700 for high-speed there.
Oh, when you guys did the spitting and all that. Okay,
yeah, that allowed us actually an even faster play out than the Phantom. And there are other cameras that are much faster than that, but those are big sports cameras and they're pretty expensive.
Well, we borrowed it when we went to Houston, and it was fantastic. Because, I mean, you have the option of shooting high-res, gorgeous video, but you can also do the high-speed stuff, which is really fun. Adam's S996 wants to know, what's the poster behind you, Adam?
This would be the Italian, yes, it is the Italian poster for Blade Runner.
Ooh.
I have a few movie posters in our collection in the house here. An original Band of Outsiders poster. I've got an original Bullet poster. Now, when you collect movie posters, the real collectors always want the poster that was from the year the movie came out in the country that it was first released in. So technically this should be an American Blade Runner poster. But the thing is that the guy, one of my oldest friends, Lomi, who introduced me to Blade Runner in New York back in like 1986, took me to the movies to show me this movie that I hadn't seen. This was the poster he had on his wall. And so this was always, and it was on his wall through all of college. And it is always the poster I associate with defining Blade Runner. And it, what's really strange is that when my wife went to go look to buy me a Blade Runner poster, she had the choice to buy the American one, but she thought this one looked better. She didn't know any of my history with it. So when she bought it, and she brought it, I was like, oh, did you talk to Lomi or Davey? And she's like, no. And I'm like, how did you know to get me this poster? It was unbelievable. Like, saw inside my brain. And so, yeah, it lives behind me here. It's got a place of pride.
Oh, that's awesome. Is Blade Runner in Italian still just Blade Runner, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's Blade Runner. Let's see. Yeah, see, it's Blade Runner.
Yeah, sure enough.
There's you know, some text. It's the year 2019. Man has constructed the perfect simile, right? The perfect replicant. Yeah, that's all I can read. It's my crappy knowledge of French that allows me to not quite read that.
Romance languages. homeless person wants to know, how does one go about getting into the CG industry for films? I live in Europe, Northern Europe. Do I have to relocate to the U.S., or is there a way to get started out here?
Where you are geographically, I have no idea, and I can't help you. I can tell you that if you're interested in being indispensable in CG, learn how to animate. Two pieces of advice. One is learn how to animate, because good animators are hard to come by and they're worth their weight in gold. The other one is build a portfolio with stuff that is quotidian, that other people know what it looks like. At one point I talked to one of the CG directors at Industrial Light Magic and asked him, you know, what do you want to see in an interview? And he said, people are always bringing me this elaborate stuff that they built and designed. And the problem is, I don't know what it was supposed to look like, so I don't know how close you got. He said, but if you're interviewing with me and you bring me a 57 Chevy built in CG, I know what that's supposed to look like. And if you got it perfectly, then I will give you a job right there, because that's a tough thing to do, to build something like that to a high level of detail. So those are my two pieces of advice. Build something everyone knows what it looks like, and learn how to animate.
Fantastic. 68 Jason wants to know, what type of boxes, what's the next box? You've made the microscope box, the Blade Runner carry, and you seem like you're on a box kick for a while.
Yeah.
Are there more boxes in the future?
Yes, actually, there's one that's been sort of kicking my butt. I built this box. I really like its form factor. It's about, I don't know, it's about 20 inches tall and about this by this in its footprint, and it opens in the front, and the problem I've been having with it is I finished the box, I really like it, and I've got some hardware for it and some pieces for it, but I don't know what the box's history is, so I don't know where to take it from here, and I'm actually, it's kind of moving through my head like a sculpture would. I'm trying to figure out what the box's history is, and I currently have this idea that it should look like it was, let's say, liberated from the basement of the Vatican. Like, my idea is that this box was on some shelf deep in the catacombs underneath the Vatican. You know, like an artifact from one of those Da Vinci Code movies.
It's a Dan Brown box.
A Dan Brown box, right. And so to that end, I've actually bought some Vatican ephemera to bolt to the front of it. But the perfect mix of the narrative with the objects that I have and the locks and the hinges and stuff to put on it hasn't quite gelled. So I've just been sort of, it sits in my shop kind of taunting me. I have it sort of centered so that I can see it each time I walk in. And, you know, I get some stuff occasionally for it and put it with it, but I haven't figured it out yet.
Fantastic. Hilux Taco asks, have you built the bag from the professional yet? I guess, is that a go bag? That's like a weapon bag, right?
That is it's actually a shooting case, is Leon's bag from the professional. It holds like four or five handguns and a bunch of grenades and a bunch of silencers. I actually I went so far as to get ready to commission someone from the Replica Prop Forum to build that case for me, and then they had a terrible family emergency happen that they had to turn the commission down. And I'm hoping that everything's going smoothly with their family. They passed on the job to someone else, but that person hasn't contacted me. So I'm hoping at some point to commission that, because I've always loved Leon's case from The Professional.
The weapons hold, I assume that you're going to know what this means, because I don't, but the weapons hold says, Adam, are you interested in space-saving modern architecture? Is that an IKEA reference? Space-saving modern architecture.
No, I think it sounds like the person might be talking about microhousing, like people building the little shacks for a few thousand dollars that are 8x10 and have all the amenities of life in them. I actually follow that fairly closely. Also, stuff that Habitat for Humanity has done, contests that have happened in the rural South for inexpensive homes that are really livable but only cost $10,000 to build. Mm-hmm. I do actually keep tabs on that field. I'm very interested in it. I always feel like when I see that kind of stuff, boy, I feel like Jamie and I could do some real problem solving in that genre of architecture, because I think that inexpensive housing is totally an achievable goal with the materials and processes we have available to us right now. I have always wanted to stay in a Japanese coffin hotel. It's just something that I feel like should happen at some point. So I am totally interested in that field. That's a good spot.
The William Gibson prophecy. I love seeing those videos of the people who've taken like a one-bedroom apartment and made, you know, the crazy dense like three-story lofts with the pull-out drawers and the bed that folds out of the wall.
And there was that one from New York recently, which was a little bit weird because it was beautifully done. He had the walls that moved and the bed that came out and all of this stuff. But, I mean, it was clear that while it was a great idea, it was clear that it had cost... I have just gone through a renovation. I knew that had to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to achieve this tiny apartment. And I thought, obviously there's an economy of scale, but it just felt off to look at this expensive piece of real estate in New York, very lavishly outfitted to be very tiny and hopefully at some point inexpensive.
Nelson Gill asks, what is the one effects prop design maker job you would sell a limb to be able to do?
Oh.
Dream job, I guess. Dream assuming job. You don't already have it.
Well, so I am, you know, I'm still an effects maker at heart, and so I would still love at some point to design and construct an iconic piece of special effects movie hardware, right? Like, it would be very satisfying to me if on some iconic piece of science fiction movie, within a science fiction movie, the director came to me and said, I would like your particular take on this prop. Would you design and build it? Now, I don't have time to tackle a job like that right now, so I haven't told any friends of mine who are directors that I'd be interested in something like that. But still, that is a kind of a lifelong dream. I mean, it'd be lovely to have a piece that people are like, oh, I love that gun, sword, knife, go bang, whatever the prop might be, and to know that I had designed it, that it came out of my head, my shop, my design sensibilities.
So if Jim Cameron calls and says, hey, we need you for Avatar.
I would totally be there.
Okay.
Same with Guillermo, same with anybody else. Absolutely.
Excellent. What's the most expensive project either of you have ever worked on? Well, you're going to beat me on this one.
Well, expensive project, you'd have to define that because, I mean, I've worked on movies that cost $100 million, but I think you're asking more about, like, the kind of budget that I might have had. You know, I think that the space shuttle from Space Cowboys was a pretty expensive prop. I mean, that was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that was 7 or 8 of us working for several months to make that thing happen.
Wow.
And there's always this point when you're working at ILM on a model like that, you know, you spend months and months and months bringing it to this incredible level of completion, and then to film it, you need to move it to the film stages, which are across the street, which means... You know, like, 4 of you need to get on this rolling cart and push this, like, $800,000 prop across a busy street. It is a moment when you're like, boy, you know, I just hope that nothing unexpected happens right now.
It's like moving a mattress that costs $800,000.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's a part of me that's always in moments like that thinking, what's the worst thing I could do? What's the worst thing? You could just push it over. You could tip it over. I mean, it could be somewhat repairable. But, you know, honestly, just pouring some, like, bright orange paint across the whole thing would be much worse than breaking some part of it. Oh, right.
Oh, that's terrible.
It gets better. So a friend I used to work with, his name is Kundo Rabaudi. And I'm not sure where Kundo's working right now, but Kundo and I were talking about this one day, and he said, no, I've got it. I figured out the worst possible thing you could do that would cause the most amount of damage and wreck the most amount of dollars of man hours built. And it was when he was working on The Nightmare Before Christmas. And everyone in San Francisco worked on that film. So, you know, there's hundreds of model makers working, and people might not realize that it's not stop motion. Well, it is stop motion animated, but it's not claymation. Those faces of Jack Skellington, every single one is a separate sculpt. So every where he moves his face is a separately sculpted Jack Skellington head that's been sculpted and painted.
So somewhere there's a room with like thousands and thousands of heads?
Precisely. There was a room with thousands of, I don't even remember how many thousands of Jack, but there was Jack and Sally and every other character in this locked room at Skellington Productions, because they were the most important assets. People had spent years making these. And Kundo's idea was, what if you went into that room with a handful of glitter?
Oh, my God. Oh, that's terrible.
Liquid all over everything. Here's the thing. My other friend Bonnie Burton describes glitter as the herpes of crafting, because once you get it, you're never getting rid of it. It's getting on everything. Especially for stop motion animation, glitter is a nightmare, because one tiny piece of glitter, you won't even see it. You can't even tell that it's there, but in camera, it might flash to camera, and you won't know until after you've had the film developed.
Sparkles so, everywhere, right?
Absolutely. This would be wrecking literally man years of work, man and woman years of work. I have to give it up to Kundo. That's the worst I've ever thought of.
That's horrible. That is absolutely monstrous. We have time for a couple more questions. Let's see. I lost the window there. Sorry. People are asking what you think about the NSA leaks. Do we want to talk about that, or should we devote a whole
absolutely.
Episode to that?
I think that I'm really glad the guy's name isn't coming to me right now. Snowden?
Snowden. Yeah, Snowden. The whistleblower, I assume, right?
Yeah, the whistleblower. I'm heavily in the camp that he did the right thing by bringing attention to this. I think he did it in a very balanced and sane way by making sure he wasn't compromising ongoing operations or any specific agents or missions by releasing the data. But I don't think it's okay for our government to collect that kind of data. I think that's a bad idea. I think it takes you down a wrong track, and I think the worst thing people can be saying is, I have nothing to hide. Why not let the government monitor me with that level of granularity? It's totally not okay. All you have to do is look through the history of any repressive regime, either in South America or Asia or even Europe in the mid-century, to know that that way lies absolute madness. And, you know, it's one of my biggest problems with the current administration is their stance on whistleblowers. So I'm following this case really closely. I hope this guy doesn't end up going to jail for the rest of his life, because I think he's done us a real service.
Just because they're saying this isn't a tool for repression doesn't mean it can't be in the future. Once the tool's built, that's the hard part, and how you use it is up to you.
Yes. Once you've taken that genie out of the bottle, it's really hard if you put someone crappy in charge of that genie to put it back, or, you know, that bad stuff isn't going to happen from that. The idea that you're not necessarily breaking the law, you know, that idea that, like, a cop could find pretty much anything wrong with something wrong with your car in a routine traffic stop? Like, picture that expanded out to your life. Have you never downloaded a piece of illegal music? Is there no way in which you're remotely compromised, even in the most innocuous fashion? Part of having a healthy society is recognizing that there's a certain amount of cracks that people fall through. 100% security. Well, I go with Benjamin Franklin's quote that those who trade liberty for security receive and deserve neither.
Exactly. Exactly. Couple more questions. Eric Glossy says, Adam, do you have any formal education in machining? In the video we posted a few days ago where you're doing the flashlight, you reached under the spinning head, the spinning chuck, and he had a heart attack. We've talked about shop safety before. Yeah. I was there, and I gasped, I think. You can hear me on the video if you listen real hard. Well, go ahead.
You know, in his great film, A Love Letter to Plywood, Tom Sachs talks about the table saw as a witch that will take your fingers if you do not respect her. That when you are working on these machines, you are thinking only of what they could do to you. I have bruised my knuckles on the spinning head of a lathe, and you're right, that wasn't the best practice. I don't have formal education on the milling machines, on the lathes. I used to work with a great machinist named Chris Rand, and Chris worked on Skellington and a whole bunch of other ILM projects over the years. He's an amazing machinist. And his technique for teaching me was, as I was setting something up on the mill, and I'd be like, you know, locking something down into the vise and measuring it and getting ready, I'd look over at him, and he'd be watching me carefully, and he'd either go, or like this. And if he gave you this, you can keep on going, but sometimes he'd just be like, no, not at all. Yes.
Oh, that's never this, right?
Luckily I never saw that.
Let's see. Kyle, someone who I've lost in the chat here, asked, why you guys are aired around the world on Mythbusters, why don't you use the metric system for calculations? It's a lot of times, it's just a lot easier.
The main problem is that I think in the English standard system, as ridiculous as it is, I wish I thought in the metric system. It's just very natural to me to explicate and intuit things in inches and feet. I really wish I thought in the metric system. I have a full set of metric nuts, bolts, drills, taps, and everything in my shop at home. I have worked harder over the years as I've advanced as a builder to know the metric system better. Whenever I'm talking to anyone from any other part of the world, because at this point it's just us in Myanmar, right, that still use inches and feet.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. I try and do those conversions on the fly, you know, how many kilometers per mile, how many centimeters per inch, and stuff like that. And we do sometimes try and weave the metric system in conjunction with the English measuring system, but it's just not enough, and I apologize for that.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Adam. I don't have another one of these scheduled right now, but if you came in late or something, maybe you want to pick this up tomorrow. We'll have it on YouTube and on the iTunes feed for Still Untitled. Anything else you want to talk about while we're here, Adam?
This was fun. I'd like to do this again.
Good. Excellent. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks, Will.
Later. See you all.
Bye, everybody.
Killing the stream now.